loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker, and joined in studio by John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we have co-host Brian Becker in Singapore and activist and writer Hyun Lee in the studio to talk about the summit that happened today in Singapore. What decisions did Kim and Trump make, and what does this mean for the people of the world and the people of Korea? We'll continue Singapore analysis tomorrow at the top of the show, so tune in again to keep diving into this historic event. And then, while the military and foreign policy establishment in the United States is demanding that North Korea immediately denuclearize, the United States is in the midst of a $1 trillion upgrade of its nuclear weapons arsenal, and there appears to be little progress being made towards a nuclear-free world. These weapons of mass destruction have become normalized in the minds of so many, but what would it really look like if a nuclear exchange were to actually happen?
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, in a brutal confirmation of the Trump administration's hard line on refugees, Attorney General Jeff Sessions ordered immigration judges to stop granting asylum to people who are victims of gang violence or domestic abuse. Sessions is trying to use his office to sharply change U.S. immigration law. Next, Spain yesterday offered to take in a humanitarian ship stranded in international waters with 629 refugees aboard, including hundreds of children and seven pregnant women, as the new Italian government and Malta refused to let it dock. Spain's new socialist prime minister, Pedro Sanchez, said that he will allow the ship to dock in Valencia. The refugees today boarded another ship and are now on their way to Spain. Then the Red Cross and the UN have pulled out of the Yemeni city of Al-Hudaydah. How bad is the situation they're going to get? And then we continue our weekly Wednesday series, False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. Daniel unpacks the low unemployment rate and what it means for workers, and he discusses Social Security dipping into its reserves. And finally, Maine has instituted ranked choice voting, or instant runoff voting, which some argue is more fair than most voting systems used here in the United States. The first statewide vote with ranked choice is taking place today in Maine. How does it work, and is it more fair? And in other headlines, a judge will decide today whether AT&T will be permitted to buy Time Warner in a rare vertical merger where two companies that are not direct competitors merge. Reports say that if the deal goes through, Comcast is likely to try to acquire 21st Century Fox, and CVS is likely to buy Aetna Insurance. Norway will invite the U.S. to double the number of Marines who are training for cold weather combat there. 2017's batch of Marines to Norway was the first time foreign troops have been in that country since the Second World War. In a rare win for Native American treaty rights, the Supreme Court let stand a lower court decision to require the state of Washington to fix road structures that had contributed to salmon population loss by damaging habitats. These rights originate for the Swahomish people from the Stevens Treaties of the mid-1800s. Justice Kennedy recused himself as he heard the case while on the Ninth Circuit. The case fell 4-4 today. Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner took in at least $82 million last year. For Ivanka, this includes wealth from the Trump Hotel, the trust that administers the clothing brand in her name, and the Trump Organization. Kushner's income includes $70 million from companies under his family's real estate business, including the housing complex in Baltimore being investigated by the Maryland Attorney General for forcing people out of their homes. Those are today's headlines. Next up is our team straight from Singapore, reporting on the North Korea summit. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
But first, we turn to the results of the historic summit in Singapore. We're joined in studio by Hyun Lee, a member of the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea and a writer for ZoomInKorea.org. And we're joined from Singapore by our own Brian Becker, who is there covering the summit with a Sputnik News team. Welcome, Hyun and Brian.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
So, Hyun, let's start with you. What's your big takeaway from the summit? Is this a big success? Do you still have some concerns?
Yeah, you know, I woke up at 4 a.m. this morning and I looked at the document that they signed. And I think the lack of details in the document initially for me was disappointing. I was like, oh, what is this? It's so sparse. But the more that I looked at it, I realized that the agreement, when it's stripped of all extraneous details, right, which will obviously come later, and it's stripped to its bare bones, I think it clearly shows what the two leaders see as the main priorities. And the top priority is establishing new relations and a peace regime. So I think this means a fundamental change from 7 decades of war and hostility between the two countries. And it's clear that there is agreement between the two leaders that that's the main goal. And once you resolve what's at the root of the conflict, which is the unresolved status of the Korean War, then all the rest will follow. Denuclearization, retrieving the remains of the servicemen, human rights, all of those things will follow. But the main thing is to fundamentally change the relationship from war to peace.
Brian, same question to you. What are your big takeaways?
Yes. I mean, I think if you look at the joint statement, number one, point number one, the way it starts, the United States and the DPRK commit to establish new U.S.-DPRK relations in accordance with the desire of the peoples of the two countries for peace and prosperity. That's just what Hyun mentioned. That's number one. Number two, the United States and the DPRK will join their efforts to build a lasting and stable peace regime on the Korean Peninsula. Number three, reaffirming the April 27, 2018 Panmunjom Declaration, the DPRK commits to work towards complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Now, that's the first three. That really conforms to what was the fundamental negotiating position of the North Koreans. First, they wanted, as a precondition, the improvement of relations with the United States. That comes before denuclearization. Two, they wanted to establish a mechanism whereby both sides could step-by-step establish an instrument for a normalized relations on the Korean Peninsula and perhaps between the U.S. and North Korea rather than constant military war or the threats of war. And thirdly, then, that lays the basis for what the DPRK says is the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula on all sides. Of course, the United States is a nuclear power and occupies parts of Korea, a part of Korea, and also has routinely flying B-1, B-2, and B-52 bombers that are nuclear bomb-capable aircraft around the Korean Peninsula. That's the way to get to number three, to denuclearization. So I think it shows that the DPRK has beaten down the John Boltons and the Mike Pences and those who are demanding comprehensive, irreversible, verifiable denuclearization as the beginning of the negotiations. It's just the opposite now. So I believe that's a sign that the DPRK has not come here on its knees, but rather from a position of strength, and that in order to go forward, the Trump administration had to recognize this reality. Also, Trump in his press conference, and I know Hyun will want to talk about this more, it was quite extraordinary, the press conference he held at 2 p.m. or 2:30, a little bit after 2:30 p.m. Singapore time. It's almost 11 p.m. right now as we're talking, pre-recording this interview. Trump said he considers the U.S. South Korean war games to be a provocation, a waste of money, and he's ending these war exercises that simulate the destruction of North Korea. That was a very, very big step. He was also asked, could he envision the exchange of ambassadors, meaning actual normal diplomatic relations. He said yes. He was asked whether he would invite Kim Jong-un to come to Washington, to the White House. He said he'd like to do that. He said they will be having many more meetings in the future. When you take all of that in total, this is pretty big. This is a really, really significant step forward.
Hyun, do you want to react to that specifically about the war games being suspended? I mean, they talked about the Trump and Kim, talked about, establishing new U.S. DPRK relations. Kim said that he wanted to, quote, leave the past behind. This is really like a major historic milestone, isn't it?
I think Brian is right. The DPRK has already made some very significant concessions towards denuclearization, right? So they've stopped their nuclear missile tests. They have dismantled their nuclear test site. Apparently, according to Trump, they also announced yesterday that they will be dismantling the engine test site for their missile. They also released some American prisoners. The U.S. needs to make some reciprocal steps to build confidence, build trust, so that the discussions towards peace and denuclearization can move forward. And I think the logical step is for the United States to reciprocate by stopping the nuclear strike exercises. So I think that is shows that the Trump administration is sincere, that they're being pragmatic, and that the Boltons in his administration have been sidelined. So this is going to be a step-by-step process, a phased approach towards denuclearization. You know, as you mentioned, when they sat down to talk, Kim Jong-un made a comment about leaving the past behind. And, you know, he also said this has not been an easy road to get to this point. There were many obstacles that we had to overcome. And, you know, when we look at the history of U.S.-North Korea relations, there really have been lots of obstacles. I mean, you know, going back all the way to the Reagan administration, North Korea proposed a summit with the United States. The U.S. ignored that proposal. Even before that, the Carter administration ignored North Korea's proposal for a summit. The Ford administration before that ignored North Korea. I mean, this has been, last night's summit was decades in the making. And I think North Korea, from that historical experience, I think North Korea came to realize that the only way it could achieve fundamental resolution of its conflict with the United States, meaning ending the Korean War, it had to bring the leader of the United States to the table, and the only way to do that was to successfully complete its nuclear deterrence, which they announced they did at the end of last year. But, you know, in order to get to this point, the entire population of North Korea had to make huge, unimaginable sacrifices to get to this point. And, you know, North Korea has been consistent in its message to the United States for the past decades. You know, we want, in exchange for denuclearization, a fundamental resolution to the Korean War, replace the armistice with a peace treaty. And I think finally we got to this point because, mainly I think because three things aligned. One, North Korea completed its nuclear deterrence, which finally gave North Korea the leverage it needed to bring the U.S. to the table and also be able to negotiate on an equal footing. The second thing is that we, you know, have in the United States a leader that is not part of the traditional neoliberal establishment and is kind of naive to U.S. geopolitical interests in the region. You know, just by him calling the war games provocative shows that he is coming to this with sort of naive eyes. And then the third thing is a leader in South Korea that also has his own economic interests in engaging with the North. So I think all of those things aligned that finally brought us to this point.
Brian and Hyun, I have a question just based on the reaction so far this morning here in the U.S. press. It's been universally negative, everywhere from MSNBC to Fox News. Brit Hume at Fox News tweeted just a few minutes ago that he was disgusted with the president, that the president looked weak, that he gave away the store, that the U.S. didn't get anything in return. You can imagine what MSNBC is saying. CNN said this morning that this was a great loss for the country. It was a diplomatic embarrassment. I consider myself to be like the two of you. I don't see a downside to this. You know, we used to complain all the time during the George W. Bush administration that we had never seen an administration that worked so hard to not talk to our adversaries. And so isn't this what we're supposed to be doing? Carrying out diplomacy? So why do you think it is, Brian, let's start with you, that the American press is just refusing to go along with this?
You know, it's interesting. You're right. It's almost universal. It's awful, by the way, just so I want to get that out there. It's a disgusting, imperialist-sounding media. How dare the president of the United States treat the leader of North Korea as an equal? How dare he?
Exactly.
I mean, it's dripping with hubris and racism and arrogance. I mean, it's truly revolting. But, you know, when Hyun used the term Trump is being naive by declaring the war exercises, the U.S. war exercises, to be provocative, I think what she means is naive about how the American political establishment will react to that, not because he's wrong that they are, in fact, provocative. They are provocative. Can you imagine North Korea or Russia or China coming right off the shores of the mid-Atlantic and simulating that nuclear destruction of New York City or Washington, D.C., or on the West Coast on San Francisco or L.A. That's what the U.S. does twice a year. And so Trump, because he's not part of the establishment scene here in Washington, naively tells the truth that they are provocative when he's trying to make a concession back to the North Koreans. And Hyun is also right. North Korea has made five or at least four consecutive unilateral concessions, including moratorium on its nuclear weapons, moratorium on its missile technology, the release of three American detainees, the blowing up of its own nuclear test site. Those were four before the summit. So, yeah, Trump is naive because there's a consensus within this imperial neocon establishment that does not want peace. Trump also said he wants to bring the U.S. troops home from South Korea. He said that at the press conference today. He said there are 32,000 troops. We should bring them home. That has to be like a dagger pointed at the Pentagon, because the Pentagon never wants to bring the troops home. They always want to remain and occupy any country that the United States has ever been involved with. I mean, there are still 50,000 U.S. troops in Japan and thousands of troops in Germany. That's holdovers from, you know, World War II. So Trump is trying to make this happen, but he's going to have all of the headwinds of the establishment here. He's not following the script. The U.S. military-industrial complex does not want peace with on the Korean Peninsula because it incentivizes endless war buildups. It motivates the Asia pivot and the containment of China. There's so much going against this. And so Trump is being ridiculed for not bringing... Now, I just saw CNN when they were interviewing Jeanne Shaheen, this Democratic senator. And she, like the CNN commentators, were ripping Trump for not blasting North Korea's human rights abuses. Well, you know, when Trump met with Mohammed bin Salman from Saudi Arabia, they didn't complain about the fact that he didn't do anything about human rights abuses or the endless embrace of Israel shooting down unarmed Palestinians. That's not a problem for CNN or the Democrats. Or what about just depriving North Korean people of food and medicine as a consequence of draconian economic sanctions? Is that perhaps an abuse of their human rights, the right to live, the right to eat, the right to have medicine when they're sick? I mean, it really is a revolting response to Trump doing something actually progressive. And it shows in some ways the Democrats and the so-called liberals are actually to the right now. They are to the right. They are more militaristic and more warlike than Donald Trump, which shows a lot about how far politics have moved to the right within the summits of the American political establishment.
Hyun, how about you? What's your take on this, on the reaction of the U.S. press to the summit?
I agree with Brian. You know, for so long, the narrative in this country about Korea has been that South Korea is our ally. We saved them from the evil communists. North Korea is a totalitarian government, a threat to global peace. And so the U.S. needs to be in South Korea to protect the South from the North. This narrative, I think, has been profitable for certain very powerful interests in Washington. South Korea is a top purchaser of U.S. weapons. The U.S. has been building a trilateral missile defense belt with South Korea and Japan in the region. And using the North Korea threat has always been the primary justification for that. You know, there are powerful interests that have a very huge stake in maintaining this same narrative. And I think that attempts to undermine this process for peace in Korea will be bipartisan. You know, we saw that there was a Republican senator from Alaska who added an amendment to next year's Defense Authorization Act that's aimed to prevent troop reduction in South Korea. We saw Chuck Schumer's letter to the White House calling for anytime, anywhere inspections of North Korea's nuclear facilities, which, you know, no country in their right mind would ever allow an enemy state to come and inspect any of their military bases at any time. I think we have great challenges ahead. Josh Rogan in the Washington Post last week had a very instructive article. He talked about the last time there was actually serious discussion about the drawing down of U.S. troops in South Korea, and that was during the Carter administration. And he described the tremendous pressure that President Carter received from the Pentagon and the CIA that he finally gave in. And he quoted a Pentagon official during that time speaking on the Pentagon campaign to obstruct Carter's plan of withdrawing troops. And he said, quote, "We began a rearguard action to delay it, water it down, mitigate the decision as much as possible. When we look at the past 20 years of nuclear negotiations between the U.S. and North Korea, each time there was a breakthrough, there were forces in the United States that always found a way to sabotage and undermine the process." So I think we should anticipate that we're going to, and the Trump administration will face the same kind of challenges. I mean, you know, already you mentioned all the pundits that are denouncing the summit agreement. And, you know, Trump has indicated that this is the first summit of a series of meetings that are upcoming, and the details of the agreement, I'm sure some of it has already been worked out.
And in fact, Trump even said that he would welcome Kim to the White House.
Yeah, exactly. So I think there's still a long road ahead, and we should anticipate that there will also be many challenges ahead. And it will be very important for us to make sure that, push the administration to follow through on this very historic agreement.
Brian, the United States has waged what could be described, I think, as an economic war against North Korea. The, you know, suffocating sanctions that administration after administration has imposed, what Trump refers to as the maximum pressure strategy. The joint declaration that came out of the Singapore summit talked about peace, but it also talked about prosperity. In fact, that was the formulation, contribute to peace and prosperity of the Korean Peninsula. Do you see in the offing some type of economic relief for North Korea?
Well, I think by the way, Trump started his press conference with that really absurd video that he gave to Kim Jong-un at the beginning of their declaration. And it was really surreal. But the video made, I guess, by the Trump supporters or by Trump's White House showed that what a wonderful and prosperous and economically going forward spot North Korea would be if only they give up their nuclear weapons. It was kind of weird and colonial in its orientation, as if the North Koreans were there on their knees and they were giving them one last chance, when in fact, you know, the Korean people as a whole in the North and the South and have created, you know, tremendous economic miracles. I mean, Pyongyang was a completely destroyed city by 1951-52. And within a few years, North Korea was able to rebuild it. I mean, unlike most Americans who are caricaturing and stereotyping North Korea, I've actually been to North Korea. And so this idea that North Korea is completely dependent on outsiders for help to become strong. What North Korea really needs is to have the sanctions lifted and not just to be sort of drawn into some grand sort of utopian economic design by the Trump administration. But how will the sanctions lift? Well, the United States, through the Security Council, has imposed really severe sanctions. And Russia and China signed on to them. They went along with them for their own reasons. Whether that was a good idea or not a good idea, we can discuss that perhaps at another time, but it certainly seemed to be appeasing the United States with the hope of keeping the discussion within the framework of the Security Council and the UN rather than allowing the U.S. to act unilaterally. But Russia now and China now and the world now sees that it's North Korea that's taking all of the bold steps to achieve denuclearization, that the North Koreans have made many concessions. And I think you could see even by some of the statements from China today that they are preparing to ease the economic pressure on the DPRK. And I'm sure that that would be true for Russia as well. China and the DPRK share a 900-mile border. If the end of the day here is that the United States, because of all of the forces arrayed against normalization of relations, if those forces succeed in crushing this effort, which they are trying to do right now, I still believe that the DPRK will have strengthened its position because I believe China and Russia will believe that it's incorrect and unfair and irrational after all of this to be still punishing the DPRK in the way that it's been punished by the Security Council regime of sanctions. So I think North Korea will get economic relief in the sense of a release or a relief or a loosening or lessening of sanctions, even if the process stops, because I think China and Russia will not continue just with the U.S. program.
Yeah, and point three that Trump and Kim agreed to reference the April 27th Panmunjom Declaration, that was the product of a summit between South Korean President Moon Jae-in and Kim Jong-un. Talk about what this development in Singapore means for inner Korean relations. You know, what might the South Korean government do next to keep the ball rolling? I mean, what does it mean for the Korean people who overwhelmingly, North and South, want reunification?
I think the Panmunjom Declaration was very significant. There were three very important things that were in that document. One was a reaffirmation that the two sides will not attack each other. Two is that both sides will reduce their troops. And the third is that they will pursue a peace agreement with the United States and China, a three- or four-party process to turn the armistice into a peace treaty. Coupled with that is now this new agreement between the U.S. and North Korea that commit to establishing new relations and building a peace system. I think that is very significant for the Korean people who for seven decades have lived under the threats of war. I think that if this peace process between the U.S. and North Korea leads to true normalization of relations, complete and irreversible normalization, including the establishment of a U.S. embassy or an intersection in Pyongyang, then I think what it will mean for the Korean people is that families who have been divided for 70 years can finally reunite. North and South Korea can finally resume the process of unification that began in 2000 and then was stalled in 2008. I think it means that I might be the first person on that inter-Korean railway when that's finally connected. And if that happens, I will be Facebook living and reporting live to Loud and Clear from the railway.
There you go.
Yeah. I think this is really the beginning of hopefully a new era for the Korean Peninsula.
Brian, we have just 30 seconds left. You were there on the ground in Singapore. Any final impressions you want to share?
Well, not so much from the on the ground here, but I want to second what Ken is saying. The United States, the imperial power that is trying to stop this process, it's going to fail. Trump is facing a lot of headwinds, but if North Korea and South Korea are going forward, no matter what the U.S. does, if China and Russia are going forward with them, we're going to see a realignment. The United States cannot stop this process in spite of the fact that it has all this power, all of this military assets in the region. I think we're in a new day, and a new day has sort of enlivened the prospects for peace, the euphoria about the promise of the future. And I think the people themselves, the Korean people and the people of Asia in particular, are going to wrest control of this process away from the United States.
That's all the time we have left. We've been joined from Singapore by Brian Becker, who's there with the Sputnik News team covering the summit. And we've been joined in studio by Hyun Lee. She's a member of the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea and a writer for zoominkorea.org. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker and joined in studio by John Kiriakou. Now we're going to take a listen to an interview we previously recorded with nuclear expert Stephen Starr about nuclear arms and what would happen to the world if these weapons were ever used, as only the United States has actually done in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We think it's important context for the debate going on now around Korea and the Singapore summit.
The United States is in the midst of a $1 trillion upgrade of its nuclear weapons arsenal, and there appears to be little progress being made toward a nuclear-free world. These weapons of mass destruction have become normalized in the minds of so many Americans, but what would it really look like if a nuclear exchange were to actually happen? We're joined from Columbia, Missouri by Stephen Starr, a professor at the University of Missouri who teaches in the Peace Studies program on the environmental, health, and social effects of nuclear weapons. Stephen is also a senior scientist for Physicians for Social Responsibility and has a number of articles on nuclear weapons published by the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists and the Federation of American Scientists. Stephen, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me again.
Stephen, so many politicians, especially on the right wing of the American political spectrum, say and apparently believe that a nuclear war is actually winnable. What would a nuclear war look like?
Well, in order to understand what a nuclear war would be like, I think it's important to, you have to start out with, let's just say, a single large strategic nuclear weapon being exploded over a city. The article that I wrote for the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists was about what an 800 kiloton nuclear warhead would do to Manhattan. 800 kilotons, that means 800,000 tons of TNT explosive equivalent. However, TNT is not a really great analogy because better to think of a nuclear weapon like a small piece of the sun that's brought to the earth. When it detonates, it creates a fireball. The center of it's about 200 million degrees Fahrenheit. And within 1 second, it'll create a fireball about a mile in diameter. And the surface of the fireball is actually 4,000 degrees Fahrenheit hotter than the surface of the sun. So this just starts immense fires over a large surface area. It would create, under all weather conditions, about 90 square miles of a fire zone that would be instantly ignited. And then typically it'd be more like 150 square miles. And anything that's in the fire zone is not going to survive.
We're looking at your article in the Bulletin. This is the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. It's co-authored, I think, with you, Lynn Eden, and Theodore Postel. And it's published February 25th, 2015. For our audience, if you want to find the article, the title is, What Would Happen If an 800-kiloton Nuclear Warhead Detonated Above Midtown Manhattan? I want to read the first paragraph because I think it's very sort of sets the stage for people to understand what's going on. Russian intercontinental ballistic missiles are believed to carry a total of approximately 1,000 strategic nuclear warheads that can hit the U.S. less than 30 minutes after being launched. Of this total, about 700 warheads are rated at 800 kilotons. That is, each has the explosive power of 800,000 tons of TNT. What follows is a description of the consequences of the detonation of just a single such warhead over Midtown Manhattan. It's an amazing description, and you have graphics that also help the lay audience, meaning all of us, the public, sort of visualize or understand what this would mean. You start your article, Stephen, about the Russian capability. What is the American capability about the same? And is there symmetry here? Is there some sort of parity?
Yes, there is. The United States also has about 1,000, we call them launch-ready nuclear weapons, just as the Russian weapons. They typically, the land-based weapons can be launched in two or three minutes. But it's within 15 minutes for all these warheads. And U.S. warheads, the large warheads on the Trident subs are about 455 kilotons. So the fire zones may be a little bit smaller. But, you know, when you're talking about in a nuclear war, if you have thousands of warheads going off within an hour, that basically you would have tens of thousands of square miles of the surface of the earth on fire. And primarily, it would be a lot of urban areas because, you know, there's only a total of about 500 cities in the U.S. and Russia that have populations of greater than 100,000 people. And so, and most of those are going to either be include military targets or be adjacent to them. And so, it's a total nightmare scenario. But yeah, there's symmetry in that.
And are all the major cities, say, in the United States or in Russia, are they all targeted?
You know, targeting information is always that's like a top secret. And if you approach the military about this, they're going to tend to say, oh, no. You know, back in the Clinton years, they had this kind of a political thing where they had a zero targeting where the weapons were supposed to be not targeted on cities anymore. But the reality is it takes 10 seconds or less to convey target information to a warhead. So in any military, you know, confrontation where weapons like this would be launched, it'd immediately be retargeted. So yeah, there's a guy named Hans Christensen who's a real expert, has written about, they used to be called a single integrated operational plan. Now it's called CON plan, but these are the war plans that the U.S. have. And I'm sure that the Russian plans are analogous. The top targeting priorities include, you know, nuclear and conventional forces, but also the top military and political leadership, the military industrial targets, and those are a lot of those in urban and communication centers. So, you know, again, if we have a couple thousand warheads going off, you know, what are the odds that 200 or 300 cities would be hit?
I have to ask you too about fallout. You know, we talk so much about cities or installations that are specifically targeted, but then that nuclear cloud has to go somewhere. And in the event of the use of multiple nuclear weapons, what about the chances of a nuclear winter? What about the chances of the sun being blocked out and this nuclear cloud moving over greater populations?
Right. Well, I've referred to some peer-reviewed studies that they were produced at the UCLA, University of Colorado, Boulder, and Rutgers around 2007. And these were updated nuclear winter studies from the original ones that were in the 1980s. And they used state-of-the-art computer models, and they're the same computer modeling that's used to predict weather. But these are the top climatologists in the world, and they estimated the environmental impact of nuclear war. And this is the primary impact they found in their climatological approach was what the smoke would do. The smoke, of course, is going to be radioactive, as you imply, and that's got a whole other series of implications. But, you know, the one warhead that we talked about initially, the 800 kiloton warhead, there's, say, 150 square miles on fire. If you have a couple thousand of those, the scientists estimated that somewhere between 50 to 180 million tons of soot and smoke would rise up quickly above cloud level because it kind of it's heated by the sun too. And once it gets into the stratosphere, it takes about 10 days for it to circle the Earth. And then in a relatively short period of time, it would form a very dense global stratospheric smoke layer. Because it can't be rained out by the clouds, it will remain there for a decade or longer. And so that has a massive impact. A large nuclear war, they predict, would block up to 70% of the sunlight in the northern hemisphere and 35% in the southern. So this would make it at noon, it would almost be looking like the sun at midnight. It would create below freezing temperatures every day in the central U.S. and central Eurasia for 1 to 3 years. It would completely eliminate growing seasons for quite a few years, maybe as many as 10 years. So what that means is most people and animals would starve to death. So I've talked about that a lot because you don't even have to talk about radioactive fallout if the nuclear winter is going to eliminate agriculture.
Yeah, the smoke, the radioactive smoke will do it. We've had a Hans Christensen, who you mentioned, who's an expert also on nuclear weapons, and Daniel Ellsberg, our friend, on this show where we've talked about the impact of smoke and the impact of the radioactivity, not to mention the fire and the initial impact. I mean, it's almost beyond sort of comprehension in a way. We want to talk about it, though, because we should be comprehending it, because this is the weapon systems that we are paying for. These are the weapon systems that are being modernized, not eliminated right now. We're joined from Columbia, Missouri by Stephen Starr. Stephen is a professor at the University of Missouri. He teaches at the Peace Studies Program on the environmental health and social effects of nuclear weapons. And he's published many, many articles, including for the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. Stephen, when we think about it, again, not comprehensible in a way beyond our imagination, how did we get to this point? I mean, it all started with one nuclear and then a second nuclear bomb on the cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August 1945. And then it seems that this arms race where all countries that want to, well, not all, but many want to have nuclear weapons, These are weapons that actually can't be used without not just extinguishing the enemy, but extinguishing life. Anyway, it's an amazing sort of terrible legacy tragedy, and it's had its own powerful life, I guess, the life of this death machine.
Right. I think, you know, what happened after World War II was that the scientists that had produced the weapons were basically begging to prevent a nuclear arms race, but it really wasn't in their hands anymore. And the military tended to look at these weapons. Well, first we had atomic bombs, you know, the atomic bombs that destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki is very, I hate the word small, but it's the explosive power. The strategic weapons that we use, we're talking about now, are at least 7 to 85 times more powerful. And we had a lot larger weapons that were typical back in the '50s. What happened is they invented the hydrogen bomb, the thermonuclear bomb, in the early 1950s. And then we started stockpiling those. And I honestly think that, you know, we had this mindset, you know, you always have more bombs than the other side, but somehow they lost track of the fact that like 300 of these weapons would utterly destroy any nation. And so we wound up, you know, by the 1960s, whether we knew it or not, we basically had a self-destruct mechanism for the human race. And this went on to, I think in 1986, there were about 60 to 70,000 nuclear weapons that were operational and deployed, primarily, you know, 95% U.S. and the Soviet Union. You know, then right about that time was when the first nuclear winter studies came out, and they were unusual because these were scientists that were were mostly working for NASA, using the NASA Cray computers that were state-of-the-art computers back then, relatively primitive climate models, but they came out and predicted that you know, a war would cause the nuclear winter that would wipe out most of the human race. And I think that was one of the main motivators for the arms control treaties that followed later on in the early 90s when they were signed. But, you know, we seem to have forgotten that. And it worries me very much. You know, I wrote an article for the Federation of American Scientists called Turning a Blind Eye Towards Armageddon. And it was about the fact that the U.S. leadership has rejected the nuclear winter studies. One of the guys that I work with, Greg Mello, he's on your show, has provided the information that made it clear that the people that are actually making decisions about the weapons and targeting are they said we don't believe that. So, you know, they've rejected these peer-reviewed studies that are the best science that we can provide that have been out there for 11 years. We're still moving forward with nuclear modernization and nuclear war games. It's like they don't want to acknowledge us. So the scientists are very much distressed about this. It's kind of hard to know what to do. You know, you think if you put a warning out like this, that people would listen.
Yeah. And the weapons we're talking about now, strategic nuclear weapons, 75 to 80 times as strong as Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Now, Stephen, I wish I didn't have to ask you to do this, but because so many people don't know, I mean, it's not really taught in our schools, and it's not really a subject of public education through the media. What actually happened using this, quote, small atomic bomb to Hiroshima and to Nagasaki?
Well, an atomic bomb like of that type, a 15 kiloton, 15,000 ton TNT explosive equivalent, which are typical of the weapons that a country like India and Pakistan first produces, an emerging nuclear weapon state, you know, that creates a fire zone about 3 to 5 square miles in diameter. And so, but the thing is, these weapons still create these horrendous, like, solar-like temperatures. So they'll create a firestorm where within the fire zone, no one's going to survive. If you detonate the bomb to maximize thermal effects of fire, then the fireball will not touch the surface of the earth. That was the case in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But if you're trying to say dig out a crater where there's a military facility and the fireball does touch the earth, then it vaporizes everything, and then enormous amounts of fallout will go up. And we really haven't, you know, we saw that with some of the nuclear tests. And by the way, you know, the U.S. had 100 above-ground nuclear tests in Nevada, and the whole North America, Mexico, Canada, but the United States had fallout all over it. And they've kept those maps classified for a long time. But I think it's had profound health effects. I think it was like probably one of the worst environmental disasters that could have happened. But that's a separate story.
Stephen, is there such a thing as a defensive nuclear weapon? Is that possible?
Well, you know, the whole argument with nuclear weapons is deterrence. And they've created a language craft around that to say, well, they don't talk about weapons. They say, well, we need our deterrent. Well, who can be against the deterrent, right? So it's a very clever sort of way to market it. But deterrence is a hypothetical. You know, in order to have nuclear deterrence, you have to have everybody has to be sane to begin with 24/7, because it's premised on the idea that our deterrent will keep you from attacking us. And in other words, it'll create unacceptable retaliation or destruction. But that unacceptable is kind of depends on the mind of the attacker, right? I mean, what if they're not afraid of death, or what if they're crazy? I mean, we have had leaders in not too long distance past that were, I mean, pretty certifiable. And
why talk about the past? Why talk about the past?
So in other words, if you think nuclear deterrence will work perfectly forever, I think that's a lot more naive than think it's possible to eliminate these giant arsenals that threaten the human race.
Stephen Starr is our guest. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. We're spending the entire 30 minutes in this segment talking with Professor Starr about what it would look like to have a nuclear weapons attack, or for there to be a nuclear exchange. Again, going back to your article that was published in 2015, you can find it at thebulletin.org. It's the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. Here's what it says. The initial fireball, the warhead, this we're talking about one, just one strategic nuclear weapon detonated over Manhattan. The warhead would be detonated slightly more than a mile above the city to maximize the damage created by its blast wave. Within a few tenths of millionths of a second, I mean, we don't even know what that is, after detonation, the center of the warhead would reach a temperature of roughly 200 million degrees Fahrenheit, about 100 million degrees Celsius, or about 4 to 5 times the temperature at the center of the sun. I mean,
can't even comprehend it.
Again, it's beyond comprehension.
Right. And so, you know, if you are 9 miles away from that point of detonation in your direct line of sight, you'll receive first and second degree burns.
How far away?
9 miles.
9 miles away.
Crazy.
So what that means is that anything in that area gets ignited. I mean, anything that's remotely flammable, within 10 to 15 minutes, all these innumerable fires will join together into one gigantic mass fire. The fireball goes up like 300 miles per hour and creates this giant chimney effect. So it creates hurricane force winds that go in towards the center of the fire. And it's strong enough to uproot trees. You know, it'll suck people back into the fire if you're even on the edge of it. And within 10 or 15 minutes, all the air within that fire zone is above the boiling point of water. So it's impossible to survive. That's why my website, I focus primarily on thermal effects with my nuclear firestorm simulator. Because, you know, the blast is what war planners focus on, you know. But if you happen to be a civilian in a fire zone, then that's you're doomed. And those are the prompt effects, you know. I mean, I've worked at the UN for a number of years trying to, I was the first person, I think, to take these studies, the new studies on nuclear winter, in 2007 and present them at the UN. And, you know, there's 122 nations that have signed on the treaty to eliminate nuclear weapons. There wasn't so much interest, but, when these countries, particularly, say, those in the Southern Hemisphere, figured out that their populations are likely to starve to death from nuclear winter, then they get a lot more interested in preventing a nuclear war.
The United States is demanding that North Korea give up its nuclear weapons. And North Korea says right now that they favor denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. I'm looking at some of the interviews, like including from James Clapper, the ex-director of National Intelligence.
Well, the guy that lied to Congress, right?
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, the statute of limitations for that expires.
Well, what was his
exact?
I think he didn't admit to lying. I think he said it was the least untrue thing
right.
he could say.
Yeah, but the answer was yes, and he said no.
Yeah, it was the least untruth. No. The answer was yes. But he's making the argument now that the North Koreans are actually trying to trick Donald Trump by demanding that all of the nuclear weapons in or around Korea, including US nuclear weapons, sort of be taken out of the area, and that the U.S. not provide South Korea with a nuclear umbrella. And so he's saying, well, the North Koreans are trying to trick us because we, the Americans, insist really. I mean, that's what he's saying. What he's really saying is that we insist that the Korean Peninsula not be denuclearized. We just want North Korea to be denuclearized,
right,
so that we can have a sole monopoly on nuclear weapons. I mean, why would North Korea, Stephen, go along with that?
I think that people also lose sight of the fact that, you know, we can hit any point on the globe with a nuclear weapon within 30 minutes. And we have Trident subs that also carry nuclear-armed cruise missiles. So if there's forward-facing nuclear weapons, sometimes seems to me to be more of a political statement than military, because I mean, it's very dangerous, I think, because the more you disperse nuclear weapons and make them available to lower levels of command, the more likely they are to be used if any sort of, or even stolen, you know, but you can forget about that. But I think the real crux of the matter is that does North Korea want to get rid of their, or do they trust the U.S. enough to get rid of their nuclear arsenal?
Yeah. Here's what he said. Here's what Clapper said on national TV yesterday. I think they should just about, it's unclear, listening to what the North Koreans might say when asked what it is that would take you to feel secure so you don't need nuclear weapons. And one more point we ought to think about. When we say denuclearization of the nuclear, denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, this could have been a two-way street, and the North Koreans could start to assert that we have a responsibility to denuclearize and restrict our nuclear umbrella, meaning no B-1s, B-2s, or B-52s flying into the Korean Peninsula, landing in the Korean Peninsula, or in operational proximity. So it seems to me that those are the things they ought to discuss. Clapper, though, is afraid of that. So yes, I hear you about forward placement of weapons, maybe unnecessary, maybe mainly a political statement, but certainly for the people in Korea who endured 3 years of U.S. bombing from 50 to 53, to have B-1s or B-2s or B-52s, all of which are advanced nuclear, you know, platforms flying around them, it keeps them in a state of constant tension, constant alert.
Well, you know, it gets back to the fact that the Korean War never really ended. And that's why I think it's better that the North and South Koreans are talking about and normalize relations. I see that as the most important political development that's going on. I mean, the U.S., in the Korean War, the U.S. literally destroyed every building in North Korea. You know, about 30% of the North Korean population was killed, and these were primarily from like 38,000 tons of napalm that we dropped on there. It's another thing that you really don't learn about in our schools. But, you know, the Koreans have a very vivid memory of that, just like the Russians have a very vivid memory of losing 28 million people in World War II. So it's going to be pretty hard to convince them that they should trust the U.S. And the problem with people like Clapper is that they don't believe in any sort of disarmament in the first place. And like you said, you know, those nuclear weapons are always okay if there are weapons. Every country looks at it like that.
They're democratic. They're the weapons of the free world.
Yeah, every country views their own nuclear arsenal as important and safe. It's just the other countries' arsenals that are dangerous. But so then you wind up right now when we have a total of, you know, something like, I don't know, at least 14,000 intact nuclear weapons. And the scientific studies show that, you know, just the detonation of a couple thousand of those is going to be enough to wipe out the human race. You know, what do we do? I mean, I personally think it's a lot smarter to acknowledge this. You know, President Putin has been probably the one leader who's come closest in recent memory to publicly warning about the danger of nuclear war, I mean, the existential threat, but he hasn't elaborated on it. And I think that Russia and the, you know, Russian people in the U.S., all people would be well served if some leader would come forward and publicly discuss these scientific predictions about nuclear winter and even allow the scientists to speak, because people don't know about this. I really, you know, it's part of the reason I teach a class at the University of Missouri. The students that come in are very smart, but they don't know the difference between an atomic bomb and a hydrogen bomb. In about three weeks, they're horrified by what they've learned. And even the most gung-ho guys will right off the bat say, well, no, we should never have a nuclear war. And that should be the starting point of all discussions on nuclear weapons, is the existential threat they pose to the human race.
You know, when I was in college, a film ran on television called The Day After. You might remember this. And it was so graphic and so impactful. It showed what would happen the day after a nuclear attack on the United States. And
yeah, that was actually Kansas City in Missouri. Where
yeah, that's right. It was Kansas City or Lawrence, Kansas, something like that. And
yeah.
it was clear that it's just simply not winnable. And even though it was fictionalized, of course, the conclusion has to be the same everywhere. It's just simply not winnable. It kills everybody, civilians and military alike. And there's just no way for humanity to get past something like that.
Stephen Starr, how much are we spending on nuclear weapons, by the way, or have we spent?
Well, a guy named Stephen Schwartz has done a lot of work on that. He used to be one of the editors at the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, and he calculated something like $7 trillion in the U.S., and that was a few years ago. You know, I've been upset because under Obama, they basically made a deal where they're going to rebuild the entire nuclear weapons manufacturing infrastructure in the U.S., and that's even in Kansas City, Missouri, again, they have a plant where they produce 80% of the non-nuclear components for nuclear weapons. It was one of the largest building projects in the state for a while, and I kept thinking, you know, can't we do better than this? Wouldn't it be better if we were like building like a square mile of solar collectors or something like that, or wind farms instead of bombs? But, you know, we get back to a general ignorance. As long as you can wave the flag and say, well, these are for our defense and it's patriotic, and if we didn't have these weapons, the country wouldn't exist. These are kind of the arguments they always fall back on. But I just think that it's time to recognize that these weapons also, if they're used, will eliminate the United States along with just about every other country on the planet.
Stephen, we have 1 minute left. I mean, what's the scenario in which they would be used? All the contingency planners know this is the extinction of humanity, or maybe they don't, but they might. What's the scenario? How could it happen?
Well, what I worry about is sort of an incremental. I mean, the problem is if the U.S. and Russia get into a direct military conflict, or even the U.S. and North Korea and nuclear weapons are used, then it opens up this Pandora's box. Both sides in the U.S. and Russia are tasked with destroying the other side's nuclear forces in the event of war. And once any military conflict would break out, whether it be in Ukraine or Syria or someplace like that, and shooting starts, we move up to a whole different level, you know, DEFCON 2. I mean, we're at the point where they're ready to push the button. And so then any false warning of attack, I mean, that we've had a lot of those in the past, could trigger a retaliatory strike for a non-existent first strike. You know, we could launch the weapons believing that Russia had launched at us and we're wrong. But I don't necessarily see a deliberate attack out of bolt out of the blue, but I think that if we were stupid enough to get into a military conflict,
yeah, we're going to pay the price. We're going to pay a very steep price.
It's going to ratchet up. It doesn't take very long. Everything, the electronic connections and the computers and everything are so fast that all these signals. Cuban Missile Crisis, we had liquid-fueled rockets that took, you know, 24 hours to fuel up. And now it's just 15 seconds that the president give the launch order.
Living or almost dying on the edge.
And we're out of time, unfortunately. We were joined from Columbia, Missouri by Stephen Starr, a professor at the University of Missouri. He teaches in the Peace Studies program on the environmental, health, and social effects of nuclear weapons. And Stephen's also a senior scientist for Physicians for Social Responsibility and has a number of articles on nuclear weapons published by the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists and the Federation of American Scientists. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.